Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Mark Silk on the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom, commonly known as USIRF. A little bit about our guest, Mark Silk received degrees from Harvard, including a PhD in medieval history, then joined its faculty. He then became an editor of the Boston Review and later on the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he worked variously as a reporter, editorial writer, and columnist. In 1996, he became the first director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life, and in 1998, founding editor of Religion in the News, a magazine published by the center that examines how the media handle religious subject matter. In 2005, he was also named director of the Trinity College Program on Public Values in Hartford, Connecticut, comprising both the Greenberg Center and a new Institute for the Study of Secularism in Society and Culture. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Dr. Mark Silk. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Fred. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. So last week, we ended up with you saying, amidst some criticism of USIRF, you indicated that, you know, they have done some good stuff, especially during this current administration. So elaborate on that.
Well, I think we might have a conversation. I mean, there are certainly going to be people who wonder whether it's good stuff. I think what I would say is just to have a commission with some of its most prominent members, such as Tony Perkins from, you know, Focus on the Family, or whatever it's called now, a leading evangelical supporter of the president, having his name on press releases that support the, and express concern about the plight of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar and the Uyghurs in China. It's useful to have, just from a kind of larger point of view, to see that there's an American agency that's under, in some sense, it's not part of the administration, but it's an independent agency, and some of the president's leading supporters supporting religious freedom for Muslims, that's a good thing. I'm sure that there will be some people who would say, well, that's just, doesn't really express what the Trump administration is interested in, and so on and so forth. But look, when you've got, egregious examples of in the case of the Rohingya, genocidal attacks on a religious community and people having to flee as refugees, and that's supported by that concern is raised by an independent government agency. It's hard to stand here and say, that's stupid or that's corrupt or anything like that. I don't think it is. As we talked about last week, I think there are some structural issues involving that are problematic with USIRF. And one thing I didn't mention but is worth talking about is just the degree to which, when you have this independent agency, the sort of responsibility for dealing with religious liberty issues as they arise gets sort of shoved into an agency that has no power to do anything. But, Congress can say, let USIRF deal with it. And the administration can say, for those issues, USIRF is on the case and State Department doesn't have to get involved. I think there's that kind of thing to worry about.
Does the State Department actually have an arm that, I believe they do, that monitors all human rights around the globe?
Well, they do issue reports on human rights, and they issue a religious liberty report, which USIRF duplicates. I mean, there is a sort of duplicative function, which you know, once you say, you know, why are we producing two separate ones, and what's the status of one versus the other, and so on. There have been some proposals from within USERF that instead of doing this sort of covering the waterfront, looking, here are countries of concern. I mean, that's part of the issue. You know, the State Department then ranks and, gives certain marks to particular countries as levels of concern about religious liberty or religious freedom in those countries, and then USERF will come along and say, well, it would really be a good idea if you raise the level of at which these concerns or the ranking level for religious persecution that some country has. Of course, none of that stuff, whether it comes from USERF or the State Department, tends to have much effect on U.S. policy, and this is a whole other area that to talk about, which is if you're concerned about these religious liberty, religious freedom issues abroad, what do you gain by just jumping up and down and saying, Chinese, you're persecuting the Uyghurs, or some entity, and then you're continuing, the administration continues to do business, Congress doesn't do anything about it. It's sort of, there are reports in the press and from nonprofit agencies about, concentration camps for Uyghur Muslims being set up all over China. I mean, saying nothing about the treatment of Tibetan Buddhists and the resettlement of Han Chinese in places with religious and ethno-religious minorities. I mean, these are all concerns, but if there's no real teeth to them other than, jaw flapping by an independent agency that serves to annoy countries but doesn't have any effect. What exactly are we accomplishing here?
Has there been a modern administration that really has stood up for minorities and actually developed teeth? Given a report by the State Department or by USERF and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are not, this is no longer business as usual, whether it's with the Chinese or the Russians, whomever. Is there anybody like that? Anyone come close?
I would be willing to, to stand corrected, but I think the record is that in the kind of scenario you lay out, USERF expresses concern, and administration says, "Oh my goodness, we hadn't really been thinking about them. We must do something about it." And now we're now imposing some kind of sanction. I mean, that I think has not happened. That's not to say that USERF doesn't, from time to time, add its voice to a chorus of nonprofit or agencies, independent agencies that monitor religious freedom as part of monitoring human rights violations generally, and that at some point an administration might choose to get involved. I mean, look, at the very beginning, when USERF still was just coming into being, it's not to praise USERF particularly, but belatedly and slowly, but nonetheless, in fact, the Clinton administration intervened in the former Yugoslavia to protect Bosnian Muslims against Serbian attacks. So, there are various ways in which you can add your voice to a chorus. The chorus may be the International Court of Human Rights and so on in Europe. And, I don't want to say, there's no effect, but there is a legitimate reason to wonder whether the status quo ante before the whole law was passed, where violations of religious liberty were handled quietly and you know, sort of independent of, or you know, sort of without raising a lot of fuss, that might have done more good. It's, you know, there's sometimes an important function for a public pulpit.
And
the cases.
Right. And I'm really speaking right now outside of the, including but also outside the boundaries of USERF. I'm talking about the United States government. So, for instance, I'm always seeing photographs of government officials, Congress people, Nancy Pelosi in particular, as of late, being honored by Tibetans, and mm-hmm. reading articles about them being honored by Tibetans. So clearly there is a bipartisan support for the Tibetan people. But I'm just wondering, what are the consequences for the nation of China for their treatment of, just for now, the Tibetans? You know what I'm saying? Do we do something?
I think there's precious little help that's, you know, rendered to the Tibetan Buddhist community in Tibet. Of course, the Dalai Lama lives outside Tibet, and you know there is a, as I understand it, I mean, a perpetual sort of tug of war between administrations and the Chinese over, you know, do we welcome the Dalai Lama to the White House? What kinds of outreach? I mean, they, you know, they hate that kind of thing. These are sort of symbolic acts that the Chinese take seriously. And if we can, sort of go ahead and say, you know, the president's going to meet with the Dalai Lama, he's a good guy, and up your nose with a rubber hose. You know, we can do that, and I'm not here to say that's a bad thing, or that the president should kowtow to the Chinese.
Oh no, I'm saying that, yeah, I'm fully supportive of it. What I'm asking is, does the United States ever go further and say, okay, China, you're going to do this to the Uyghurs, you're going to do this to the Buddhists, we're going to do this to you, other than the symbolism of having the Dalai Lama come to the White House or come to the state, come to the United States Capitol? You know, that's what I'm saying. I still think that we're more interested in doing business with China than we are in really calling it on the carpet for their abuse of, you know, people of faith and others, you know, anybody who's not a member of the party.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the important sort of things to think about is if an administration, you know, say beginning with the Carter administration in the late 1970s, signals to the world that it really cares about human rights, about religious freedom, about, you know, minorities not being able to do their thing. You know, it serving that kind of notice can have an effect. It can have an effect in a way that is hard to measure, because it's in what has not been done. In other words, so let's say that, you know, Hillary Clinton had been elected president and expressed, you know, grave concerns about the treatment of the Uyghurs and or some other group in some other country, which is less, you know, hard to push around than the Chinese. But even in the case of China, you know, there can be reasons why the Chinese, without, you know, while even denouncing this kind of meddling in their internal affairs, don't do something that they would otherwise do. In other words, to not express concern about human rights and democracy, as as the Trump administration has generally not, means that repressive efforts are gonna you know, go forward more readily than if the United States is there sort of saying, you know, that's a violation of the Helsinki Accords, and you know, we're not going to meet with your ambassador, and as for this particular favor that you might want, you know, think about bringing it up next year. I mean, you know, this kind of back and forth, which is not, which never takes the form of, you know, we will withdraw most favored nation trading, you know, status from you if you don't, you know, stop treating this group badly, and the other country says, oh, we'll stop them because we want most favored nation status. I mean, you know, you don't see it play out that way. And so, you know, unless you know from the inside what the real deal is, it is, and you may never know, or at least you may, you know, have to wait for the memoirs, and some of it may be classified for a long time. You know, it's hard to say, and so, you know, I would be cautious about, and I am cautious about just sort of saying, you know, we've never done anything. I think the whole, you know, this whole story that I told last time about how USURF came about was precisely in the context of a quiet diplomacy, concerns expressed by people who matter, and not embarrassing countries while protecting people who you know, seem to be oppressed. You know, I think these are tricky questions of international diplomacy that one has to be. I mean, one has to be to recognize the trickiness of them.
Sure. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Mark Silk. He is from the Trinity College Program on Public Values in Hartford, Connecticut. And we're talking about USURF, the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom. Mark, let me switch gears just a little bit here. I want to talk a bit about you. Tell me how your PhD in medieval history prepared you for the work you're doing right now.
Well, I have had a checkered career, so, you know, the simple answer is it didn't. I started off thinking I wanted to be a medieval historian, and at some point I began, partly through substantially through my father, who was a journalist, wrote economics columns and editorials for the New York Times, and we collaborated on a book or two, and I just thought it was fun to write about contemporary things, but I had this longstanding interest in religion, and at some point decided I would learn about religion in America and write a book about religion in America in the post-World War II era. And then I needed a day job, and so I became a newspaper man in Atlanta, and at the time began... wrote a book on news coverage of religion, even though I wasn't actually, as a journalist, a full-time religion reporter, but I did a fair amount of writing about it in different capacities. And so, you know, I sort of segued into thinking about religion in our own times, and sort of on the strength of being, you know, sort of an academic, or at least Monkey, and then and a daily journalist, when Trinity College here in Hartford decided it wanted to have a Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life, they ended up hiring me to do that, to start that, and then through various friends and so on, you know, the international dimension of religion in public life seemed pretty important, and so, you know, the religious, you know, the whole USURF process by which that happened sort of was on the table pretty early on in my doing that. So, I don't know, one thing leads to another, and I've always been interested in how religion works in society, whether it was, you know, in the 12th century or in the 21st.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say while you were speaking. You know, the first thing you said is, well, it really didn't help prepare me for what I'm doing now. But, I mean, if you're studying medieval Europe, I would imagine that you're studying a lot of religion. Am I correct?
Yes, you are correct. And in fact, I've always felt that my training, you know, in medieval history prepared me extremely well to do this kind of work in two respects. I mean, one of them is, I guess not everybody would say this, but certainly people historically minded or trained as historians believe you don't understand the way things are now without understanding the way things used to be. And so just knowing a bunch of history helps understand where we are now. But also, you know, being trained to read documents carefully and to interpret them to sort of figure out how to make sense of the range of human emotions and motion and input, you know, sort of the what motivates people to act, you know, the way historians do, you know, I like to think anyway, that's been critical to the work that I've done on, you know, sort of on contemporary issues. Some people find history boring or, as Henry Ford said, bunk. But that's not how I do. I see it.
No, I am on your team there. And while we have you, we've just have a couple of minutes left. But I'll remind people that we had you on just before the midterms of 2018, and we talked about the role that religion might play in that race. And as we are now in 2020. And headed for a major, major decision in the direction of our country. Do you have any new insights that have developed since 2018 in terms of how religion might play out any differently than we assume? I mean, is it just easy enough to say, oh, the evangelicals, the white evangelicals will go for Trump, the black evangelicals and the secularists and most of the Jews and Muslims will go for Trump and case closed? Is there any more?
And Catholics will be divided.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
You know, it's. I think. You know, there are always twists to this story, though it does seem like we're sort of locked into a situation that's, you know, in which different groups, ethno-religious, racial groups are sort of pretty nailed into place. If it turns out as you know, Super Tuesday certainly revived the fortunes of Joe Biden. I think if Biden does become the Democratic nominee, and you know, sort of the pundit class, I think probably now thinks so. If that turns out to be the case, then we may have a revival of the so-called wafer wars, where some conservative Catholic prelates and others, you know, sort of, you know, make Joe Biden's support for abortion rights an issue of the communion rail. And, you know, the Supreme Court is now taking up a big abortion case from Louisiana. So, you know, and if that gets decided in terms of, you know, sort of restricting abortion rights further, and that becomes an issue on the table, you know, I think that brings, you know, quite apart from voting blocks, that makes religion and religiously motivated positions, you know, more and more salient. in the election cycle. We'll get a decision in June, and that can put that on the table. If Bernie Sanders, in some manner, gets the nomination, I think we then have a whole separate sort of set of questions. He would be the first Jewish, major party candidate for the presidency. His own, lack of sort of engagement in strictly religious activities becomes an issue, and we would be talking about the so-called nuns, the people of no religion, and Bernie is kind of their candidate as a non-religious, if ethnically Jewish, candidate. So, I think we'll have plenty to talk about if we want to do that.
Okay. Well, I believe you are correct, Mark. We're down to the wire now, but I want to thank you so very much for joining us today and last week as well.
Well, it was my pleasure to be here both weeks, and look forward to talking to you again if you want to have me back.
I am sure that will be the case. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Today we've been speaking with Dr. Mark Silk on primarily USERF, the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom, and other things. Please join us again next week here on WGVU's Common Threads.